I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. My guest today is Michelle Nishiguchi, who goes by the nickname Nish. As a professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, Merced, she runs the Nishiguchi Symbiosis Lab, specializing in the study of the association and interaction between the tiny bobtail squid and a light-emitting bacteria named Vibrio fischeri, which are relevant to the evolution of both beneficial and detrimental bacteria in humans. Before her recent move to UC Merced, she was for 20 years a professor at NMSU, where she was recognized for her outstanding contributions by receiving numerous awards, including the designation of Regents Professor in 2015. So Nish, welcome to Delving In.
Hey, thank you. Great to be here.
So let's start with your background. How did you decide to become a biologist? And how did you wind up studying the bobtail squid?
I think when I was a kid, I always liked playing around in the mud and with creepy crawly things, bringing them into the house, much to my mom's dismay. She always made me take them back outside. I think I always was curious about how things moved and how they lived. And you have such a variety of organisms, not just the animals, but the plants, you know, and I just was really curious about everything. I just always looked at stuff and wanted to know how it worked. I think that's what a lot of biologists do, is they have this kind of wonder and awe about things around them. And my biggest attraction was the ocean. So things that did that in the ocean particularly. And so one of the things in terms of working in the ocean and looking at things, I always was interested in how organisms also live together. So whether they were living copacetically or not, I just was always curious about how they got along. And so symbiosis was kind of something that I was always drawn to, because they, you know, it's the study of how things live together, whether it's beneficial or not. And that brought me to working on bobtail squid.
Okay, so we'll get to what symbiosis means in a moment, but the bobtail squid, I understand, is much smaller than the kind that's eaten. It's like the size of a pinky finger, I think, the length of it. It's this little cute little thing, right?
Yeah, a little bit bigger. They're the average size of, you know, many species, but the average size, I'd say, is about 4 centimeters in body length, or we call it mantle length. They eat them in Italy. They're called cappuccetti. They eat them in Asia like crazy. They eat all squid in Asia. So they're a good food source for a lot of places, but they happen to be a good study animal too for what we're interested in.
Okay, so did you start out with an interest in symbiosis and then choose the bobtail squid because of the properties that we'll talk about in a moment? Or is it more that you love the squid and then figured out what to study about it?
I didn't always love squid. I mean, I think I always loved squid to eat, but I didn't just like them because I wanted to study squid. And in fact, in my graduate work, I worked on interactions between bacteria and marine algae. So studying symbioses, but a different model system. I think as biologists, what you end up doing is you have a bunch of questions you want to ask, and you find a good model to be able to answer those questions. So there are some brilliant models out there in nature, but they're really hard to get to, or they're really difficult to tease apart. They're really complex. So it's not always easy to bring that system into the lab. So the trick is to find something that is interesting. It's somewhat complex, but you can tease apart the complexity in the field and in the lab. So that's kind of what these squids, how I came to working on these squids. So when I graduated from UC Santa Cruz, working on these algal bacterial symbioses, I met someone, actually I didn't meet, I met her before in my master's lab down at UC San Diego, and that's Margaret McFall Nye and her partner, Ned Ruby, who are the kind of the founders of working on this bobtail squid luminous bacteria symbioses. And Margaret and I were really good friends when I was a master's student. She was a postdoc down in San Diego. And when she left, she got her first job at University of Southern California. She started working on this system. And this was something that another cephalopod colleague of ours had said, no one's working on this system. It's really interesting. We don't know what's going on with these glow-in-the-dark bacteria in these squid. It'd be a great model to work on. And so she started developing it with Ned Ruby. and they both worked together. He's a microbiologist and she's an animal physiologist. So it was a nice symbiosis that they worked with the system together, because he had the microbiology expertise and she had the animal expertise.
Do you have to find these squid yourself? I mean, you scuba dive?
Yeah, so the squids live in, the closest ones to here are in Hawaii. There's no endemic cepheolid squids in California. I take that back. There is one, but it doesn't have a light organ. So some of the species in the family don't have light organs, which is pretty cool. But the ones that do, the closest one is in Hawaii. So there we dip net. They come out at night to feed. They're nocturnal animals. So we go out on the shallow reef lots of Hawaii, probably like in knee-deep water at low tide with flashlights, and they live on sandy bottoms. And we kind of look around and we basically dip net them. So we catch them by dip net, take them back to the lab. And the adults are our breeding population. So we actually don't do too many experiments on the adults. We do them on the juveniles. And there's a really good reason why. So they are born without these luminous spectral symbionts. They get them from the environment every time they hatch. So it's an environmental transmission that they get their beneficial bacteria from seawater. But that allows you to manipulate the system in the lab. So you can bring the adults in the lab. They mate and lay eggs. The eggs hatch. And then you can do all these really cool experiments with the eggs, with different bacteria from all over the world to see, hey, are these bacteria more specific to this host? Do they react the same way? We can manipulate genetically in the lab, the bacteria, and say, we know there are particular genes that are responsible for getting into the squid. So if we take those genes out, does it reduce the competency of the bacteria or not? Lots of things you can do. And again, working in this system where you're only working with one bacterium, one or two, and then this one species, and then this one host squid.
So let's give our listeners a sense of what symbiosis is in general and what the symbiosis is in this particular situation with these light-emitting bacteria, which sounds pretty exotic from a human point of view.
Yeah. So you're thinking, okay, so why do these squid need glow-in-the-dark bacteria? So when they are hiding during the day, everyone likes to eat squid, including lots of large fish, right? And they're little, so they hide in the sand. They bury in the sand during the day. And there are a ton of videos if you just look in Google and bobtail squid burying in the sand, you'll pull up these videos. And they bury in the sand. So they pretty much cover themselves in the sand during the day. And they just hang out there during their nap time. And then when sunset happens at dusk, that's when they come out. So that's their cue. They come out and they start to hunt. And they're almost all the species are found in clear tropical waters. So if you think about something coming out of the sand right at dusk, and the moon's starting to come up, a moon will cast a downwelling light and shadow on the animal. And so predators from below that like to eat these squid can see them, because there's going to be a big shadow. So what the squid do with the luminescent bacteria that's in their light organs is they produce enough light and match the downwelling moonlight, so they basically camouflage themselves. It's a behavior called counter-illumination, because you're using light. But this is light generated by the bacteria to fade away. So we always kid around and say it's the squid cloaking device. The other really cool thing about the light organ is that there's an ink sac that wraps around the light organ. So all squids and octopus have light organs. And these particular squids, the ink sac wraps around the light organ, and they can use it like a diaphragm on a camera. So let's say it's a new moon and there's not very much light. They can shut the ink sac around the light organ, so there's hardly any light being emitted. And if it's a full moon, there's a lot of light, it's going to be a lot of shadow, they can open up and pull back the muscles of the ink sac so that the light organ is showing, and then there's a lot of light being produced. And it's diffuse light, so it goes throughout the whole body of the squid, even though the light organs are quite small. But these bacteria are very bright. An adult squid will have about 10 to the 15th bacteria per light organ, so a lot of bacteria in there. And there are other physiological ways that they can control light production of the bacteria, but those are still being studied. It's a little bit more difficult to tease apart.
So do we know how the squid or octopus is able to tell how much light to emit, like how close the diaphragm should be of the ink sac?
Yeah. So they not only are visual animals, like most cephalopods, they have amazing visual system, but they have photophores in the light organ that actually know the attenuation of light. So if it's really bright or really dark. One of my first PhD students, Brian Jones, did some cool experiments where we had a bunch of adults in the lab. And we had an old-fashioned luminometer. This thing would measure light production from underneath. And I should mention that the way the light organ morphology is, the anatomy of the light organ is very cool. So that on the ventral side, so this would be the side facing down, there's a lens, okay? And then inside the middle of that light organ is all these little crypts, or like little channels where all the bacteria are housed. And then on the dorsal side, that would be the top side, is a reflector tissue. So the bacteria are producing light in the middle, and all the light, if light goes up, it bounces off that reflector and goes back down. So basically all the light is focused ventral or down towards the bottom of the sea, you know, or towards the sand. These guys are, like I said, in really shallow water, so 5, 10, 15 meters deep. So everything is going down because that's where they need it. They need the light to be focused downward. And then, of course, the ink sac wraps around, so then they can open and close it and modulate how much light escapes from that ventral emitting light organ.
Let's also get some clarity on what a symbiosis means, what a symbiotic relationship. I suppose in human terms, a good marriage would be symbiotic in a sense. It's mutually beneficial. I don't know if it's used that way in human.
So when people hear the word symbiosis, they think it always means a good relationship. Symbiosis just means living together. Doesn't necessarily mean it's good or bad. It kind of encompasses all that. So I always use the analogy of it can be a partnership where, like your roommate in college, where you're living together, you might be utilizing the same kitchen, but it's not beneficial, it's not detrimental. So you're just living together and that's fine. And a lot of organisms do that in terms of some of the microbiome work that's been done. There are bacteria that live together, not necessarily interacting with each other. They just happen to be in the same place. But also there are many bacteria in microbiomes.
I see. So technically it's what is called mutualism when it's beneficial, mutually beneficial?
Yes.
And it's parasitism or parasite if one side is benefit and the other side is being harmed?
Yes.
So it's all these possibilities.
But those are all considered... Yeah, they're all considered symbioses. So commensal, beneficial, or parasitism. And they also say pathogenic.
Right, pathogenic. The relevance for your work in humans, I guess, is most directly related to bacteria in humans. And my understanding is that 90% of each of our cells is not human, in terms of number of cells, not mass of cells. And that most of our bacteria are in our gut. And that most of those bacteria are helpful or are beneficial bacteria, but occasionally they're not. And so one of the reasons for studying the squid is to understand how an animal becomes a host for beneficial bacteria. I don't know if it's also relevant to the other, which is how do they become a host inadvertently for harmful bacteria?
I think it has implications in both types of symbioses. So in the squid light organ Vibrio fischeri symbiosis, it's a beneficial symbiosis. So we can learn a lot about how the partners communicate with one another. So you're taking two organisms that are entirely different. They're worlds apart in terms of their evolutionary relationship, an animal, a multicellular complex animal, and a single cell bacterium, right? But they're still able to communicate and tell each other what's going on. What happens with the pathogenesis is that there's a very fine line when you're beneficial versus when you're being pathogen. So beneficial symbiosis, you're kind of, it's give and take, right? It's like a marriage. It's not always rocking the same line evenly. It's like sometimes it goes this way or that way. And I say pathogenesis is like verging on divorce. It's like really bad in one sense. And so there, one partner is really taking advantage of the other partner to the point where it's detrimental to the fitness of that other partner, the host usually. So Vibrio fischeri has some very close cousins that are pathogens like Vibrio cholera, which is the bacterium that causes cholera disease. And another one called Vibrio parahemolyticus. That one gets into oysters, and when you eat shellfish, it makes you incredibly sick. So there are a lot of pathogens in the Vibrio family. But fischeri tends to be a beneficial bacterium. And there are a lot of other vibrios that are not harmful as well. So what makes you be a beneficial bacterium and then jump ship and cross the fence line and become a pathogen? There are very subtle genetic differences. And so that's one thing we can use the system is to see the differences. Like how does it use this suite of genes in a beneficial bacterium versus a pathogenic bacterium?
And then the squid needs to be able to tell the difference, right? It needs to know when a very similar bacteria that had been so helpful to it is suddenly just different enough to be harmful.
Usually in the squid system, they never become harmful. But what happens is that you might have bacteria that aren't doing their job. The whole reason why squid have these bacteria is they produce light. So they want their partners to make light when they need it at night. But you can manipulate the system. So let's say we know the genes that are responsible for light production. And let's say you take them out. We call them knockouts. So you mutate it, so you remove those genes from the bacterium. And then you present it to the squid. And the squid's like, no way. These guys aren't doing their job. So they'll initially take them up, but they won't take them up to the same levels as the wild type. And in fact, those numbers won't persist in the light organ, because they're not doing the job that they're supposed to be doing. So squid can usually tell who's the more familiar bacterium or the one that's deficient. They can kick them out. And those subtle mechanisms of specificity and recognition, it's kind of one of the things my lab works on, is we're very interested in the variety of bacteria. So we've collected these kinds of squids all over the world and all the strains that go along, all the different Vibrio fischeri strains that go along with these host squids. But there are very subtle differences between, say, Vibrio fischeri from Hawaii compared to Vibrio fischeri from Australia, compared to Vibrio fischeri from the Philippines. And so my lab is trying to figure out, are those driven by these different hosts, although the hosts are really similar, or the ecological differences between those habitats, or a mixture of both?
They each have their own specific kind of light-emitting bacteria, and they won't be a host to the other one's variety?
They're a little bit promiscuous. So you can present, let's say we have a baby Eupyrmonis sculpes, which is the species from Hawaii, so the Hawaiian bobtail squid. And you present the babies when they're born, because they don't have their light organ symbionts. You can present, say, Australia Vibrio fischeri or French Vibrio fischeri. Or the Hawaiian Vibrio fischeri. And the babies know that Hawaiian Vibrio fischeri are its native strain, and they will take it up preferentially over the other ones.
I'm just sort of wondering if you could expound a little bit on the advantage of being able to study the bacteria and the squid separately. I understand when you do it in the lab, you have the squid fresh out of their eggs and they don't have the bacteria yet, and you can arrange it that they're not available because it's not in the ocean. And so what does that allow you to find out?
So I'll give you an example of what we're working on in the lab. Some people in the audience might be familiar with CRISPR Cas9. So this is a gene editing technique that was discovered by a professor, Jennifer Doudna at UC Berkeley, Nobel Prize, great technology. And everyone, it made the news recently for helping this guy who has a very weird genetic disorder, and also it's helping people with sickle cell. So we're taking that technology and we're putting it into Vibrio fischeri. This is a gene editing system that a lot of bacteria have. What they use it for, it's kind of like their own immune system. They use it to cut out DNA from invading viruses so it doesn't actually get into their chromosome. But Vibrio fischeri does not have a CRISPR-Cas9 system. So it makes it great because we could put one in and put it into places where we want to be able to turn specific genes on or off at different times. So it's basically like a light switch, and you can turn it on and off whenever you want. So what we're curious about is what's going on when a bacterium gets into the light organ, and what are the cues that allows it to grow, reproduce, and then stay inside the host squid to the point where it's going to make enough light for the squid to be able to produce luminescence. That all happens in a period of about 12 hours. And so trying to decipher that, we can manipulate the bacteria outside the squid in the lab. And we have the juveniles in the lab because we bring the adults in as our breeding population. And then when the clutches or eggs are laid, we can actually, once the juveniles start to hatch, we can present the juveniles with these modified river fishery and say, okay, we're going to switch on and off the light genes, the ones that make light. And let's see what happens to the squid. Are they able to recognize whether these bacteria are making light or not? So that's one technology that we can do in the lab, which is really great. The other things we can look at is, I remember I mentioned there are different host species around the world. They contain Vibrio fischeri from these different places around the world. But the Vibrio fischeri species, they're all the same species, but there are strain types that are subtly different. So we've been trying to figure out what makes the difference between, say, a Philippine Vibrio fischeri and an Australian Vibrio fischeri. They're really subtle differences. And so trying to figure out what those differences are might allow us to determine the differences between a bacterium that can get in and infect really quickly versus one that takes a long time. And that's kind of the way pathogens work. So in a pathogenic infection, what happens is oftentimes people lose a lot of their beneficial bacteria, and it basically opens up a space in their gut or wherever where the pathogens can come in. So one of the reasons why it's so important to maintain your beneficial bacterial fauna is that they're a very competitive community that are adapted. They've evolved with us over thousands of years. And so it's very hard for a pathogen to come in and take over unless those bacteria are gone for some reason, whether you've been taking antibiotics, which kills everybody, right? And then you happen to, say, get exposed to a pathogen, but that habitat is open, right? It's lots of space to come in and say, woohoo, let's go. But anyway, so that's kind of how that works. And so we can study those kinds of mechanisms in a very closed, precise system.
I always was curious about antibiotics because it seems to me that, you know, if they killed everything off, then you would have potentially very different bacteria after than before. But I guess my assumption is that it doesn't quite kill them all off, and bacteria multiply so quickly that even if just there's just a tiny remnant of your original community of bacteria, it will replenish to be pretty much similar to how it was before.
Yeah, it depends on the type of antibiotic that you're using. So there are two different types, bactericidal and bacteriostatic. Some antibiotics just pause growth, so they don't kill the bacteria, but they just prevent them from replicating. And other types of antibiotics will kill, but as you know, some are more resistant because of antibiotic resistance genes. And it also depends on where the bacteria are. And, you know, like with oral antibiotics, you know, they can only be around so long. That's why when you're taking them, the doctor says, okay, you have a 10-day course. Do not stop in the middle of the 10-day course. Otherwise, you know, you're losing the concentration of antibiotics over time. So yeah, it just depends on the type of antibiotic you're taking and then the type of bacteria you're targeting. So it's really, sometimes people look at, say, whatever you're sick, if you have an ear infection, what's the likely cause of that and what kind of drug you're going to use to combat that. It may not kill everybody, but it's going to try to target the one that's keeping you the illness.
So this is a bit of a stretch, but can you imagine, or what do you imagine being the eventual application of your work to, let's say, the eradication of cholera? Or is that too big of a stretch?
No, I think it's not a small stretch, but I think it's good. Cholera is really interesting because the bacterium, the way it works, it gets into your gut, you drink it. So people get sick. That's why we don't have it here in the United States, because it's due to having, really poor drinking water or access to clean water. And what happens with cholera, it gets into your gut, a high concentration, you have to drink a lot of it. So you can have a little bit, it won't get you sick. You got to drink a lot of cholera in the water. And what happens is it gets in your gut and it attaches to your intestinal lining. Cholera releases a toxin, which Vibrio fischeri has remnants of this toxin, but it doesn't have a toxin, cholera toxin. And this toxin goes into your gut. It actually disrupts the ionic exchange of sodium, so positive ions. What happens is all the salt comes out of your cells. And then, as everyone knows with osmosis, when the salt goes, the water comes, right? Which is the diarrhea. The toxin doesn't kill you. It's a lot of people die of dehydration. So in third world countries, most people die of dehydration that are old. or young, because those are the more susceptible populations than, say, healthy adults. And they're more susceptible to dying of dehydration. So one of the fastest cures is to give them antibiotics for the Vibrio cholera, but also IV and give them lots of fluids. It's not something that'll kill you if you get treated the proper way. It's treated very treatable disease. But most people, like I said, it's just they have no access to clean water.
So what are the clues then from Vibrio fischeri in terms of a future treatment for cholera in addition to what you just said?
So one of the things that happens when our bacteria, Vibrio fischeri, get into the squid light organ is they come in, there are these pores that lead from the outside into the light organ, and they migrate. There's a very specific winnowing. So not all bacteria can get into the light organs. There's kind of like a tunnel. It's like they're cutting down the type of bacteria. So initially, the squid secretes the mucus around these pores, and the mucus attracts generally gram-negative bacteria, so it alleviates all the gram-positives outside. And then they kind of bolus up, and they get shunted into the pores. And then as they're going into the pores, there's a lot of chemicals that the squid produces that only Vibrio fischeri that are specific for squids can get past. They have special enzymes to combat this, like running the gamut, right? So every time the host throws something else at you, but the ones that can get into a squid that have evolved with a squid are like, ah, we can get through this. And so they make it all the way to the crypts internal to the light organ. Once they do that, then they attach to the epithelial lining of the crypts. And what's really cool, when you look at electromicrograph of that, the epithelial lining of the crypt space in the squid light organ looks a lot like your intestinal tract. And the way they settle on, they have these little pili that attach, just like cholera. So if we were to figure out ways to not have them attach so well to the lining, it'd be a really great analogy to not have cholera attached to your gut, so then it can, you know, start releasing all these toxins to cause the disease. So that's one example of how, if we understand attachment, colonization, a way they get in to the light organ, a lot of similarities to how these cholera bacteria get into the gut. We can learn a lot from that and combat cholera disease.
So there might one day be a drug that will somehow make that lining inhospitable to the bacteria?
Yeah, or you could get something that prevents the pili from adhering to the epithelial lining. So what's really cool is once the bacteria get into the epithelial lined crypts of the light organ, they start forming these biofilms. And there's been a lot of work on biofilms. They're relevant to not only pathogenic infections, but also other kind of nasty things like the plaque on your teeth is biofilm, right? And so there's a lot of biofilms that are clogging up big pipes in the ocean. And that's a big consortium. It's not just one type of bacterium, right? Lots of other things could be other organisms besides bacteria. But there are lots of uses and that we can either try to get rid of biofilms or use them to our advantage. But in this case, with the biofilms in the light organ of the squid, they need a high cell density in order to make light. So one thing I didn't mention is that light production is also a function of concentration of bacteria. So one single Vibrio fischeri cell cannot make light on its own. It has to have enough of the other Vibrio fischeri cells, and they produce a molecule called an autoinducer. And when you get enough of this autoinducer in the environment, they secrete it. What it does is it signals the other bacteria to start turning on the genes to make light. But you have to have a high concentration of this autoinducer. And the only way you get it is if you have a high concentration of Vibrio fischeri. So when you start getting this high concentration, they start all mixing together and they make this beautiful biofilm inside the light organ. And that's one way that they kind of settle in there. The Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is a soil bacterium, it's benign. You probably have some in your nose right now, but it's really bad for cystic fibrosis patients. So CF patients, you know, secrete extra mucus. It's a genetic disease that they actually end up secreting more mucus than the normal person in their lungs. And that mucus creates a really great habitat for bacteria. Now, normally, a normal person, you have some mucus secreted to keep your lungs moist. Also, that helps the cilia moves it out to get all the gunk that gets caught up in your lungs. But if you have too much, that's not a good thing. And what happens is that Pseudomonas gets into your lungs. It colonizes the mucus in these CF patients, and then it forms this great biofilm, just not bad, not good. And then it, a lot of times it kills those CF patients. It gets, that's why they're kind of in this, the person in the bubble. They can't be outside exposed to all these environmental bacteria because it'll be hard for them to clear it out of their lungs.
So the biofilm needs to be just the right texture and composition to do what it's supposed to do, it sounds like. When it's the right composition, it can attract bacteria and help it to be expelled. But if it's the wrong composition, it attracts more than can be expelled, it sounds like.
Yeah. So if we understand also the way biofilms are formed and how they persist in an animal tissue, then we can also extrapolate that to how biofilms form in human tissues, but to our disadvantage.
So you threw out a number earlier, I think 2 to the 15th, I think. Off the top of my head, I don't know if is that a quadrillion? it's amazing just how fast bacteria...
10 to the 15th.
Yeah, how fast they multiply. And one of the things that was really intriguing in one of your papers is that the squid actually expels its colony of Vibrio fischeri every day at dawn. It gets a new complement of bacteria every day. Does it expel all of it and then regenerate from a little bit, or gets totally new from the ocean every day?
So once the baby squid get infected, what's pretty cool is that I mentioned there, the line organ is bilobed. And so two lobes on either side. And then there's these three pores that the bacteria get sucked into. They get entrained. And so there are cilia on the outside of these pores that get the water moving. So the squids, when they ventilate and they suck up the water in their body cavity, because these squids doing this all the time, they shuffle water across the pore, so then the right Vibrio fischeri will eventually get in there and colonize. When that happens, this is the communication part, there's this crosstalk between the bacteria and the squid, and certain cues from the bacteria tell the squid, okay, we're in here, we're the right ones, you can close shop now. So those three pores actually merge into one. Still open to the environment, but only one. So all the crypts, there are three major crypts, the channels all now just go to this one pore. And so they colonize, the bacteria colonize. And then every morning at dawn, so this is with now the cue of sunrise, so they've been active all during the night, they expel 95% of those bacteria that have been reproducing and growing into the seawater. And those are still viable V. fischeri. They can still swim and survive and then go infect another squid or not. And the remaining 5% stay in the light organ. So then the squid buries in the sand and it's quiescent during the day. And that 5% population then starts to grow again until dusk, when the squid needs its full capacity, its quorum, to make light. Because remember I said, it takes a lot of bacteria to produce this autoinducer to turn on the Lux genes or the light making genes. So it's kind of this really cool diurnal cycle where the bacteria are really high numbers at night when they need the luminescence. And then right before sunrise, whoosh, they push out all those bacteria except for 5%. So they just leave a little bit. And then those remaining 5% regrow. So the populations, once they get infected with squid, are very clonal. Because if you think about only a few that get in there, they tend to be at most up to maybe 6 strain types. That's it. So you don't see a lot of variation in the differences, the subtle difference between the strain types in a V. fischeri in a single squid.
So the purpose of expelling them, is that just to make sure that their colony doesn't get too large? Sort of, it's basically a pruning process.
Yeah. And also, so you think about the bacteria, or their double time is 4 times faster than, say, they were in the ocean. So seawater has some nutrients, depending on where you are in the world. But like in Hawaii, it's very nutrient poor. That's why the waters are so nice and clear. So it takes the bacteria a lot longer to grow just in seawater versus if they're in a squid. So the squid's giving them, this is the exchange, right? Bacteria is producing light for the squid. The squid is giving the bacteria nutrients for them to grow, so they can grow at this speed that's much faster. But there comes a point where there's no more room to grow. There's like the lidergans are only so big and they can only house that many bacteria. Also, it starts to get the squid sick. So you can do these experiments where you don't, because you can control daylight cycle in the lab, right? So normally you have them on a 12-12 daylight, but you can keep the lights off. So that's their time where they're active. And you never turn the lights on, which would mimic sunrise. So they don't vent. It's not a circadian rhythm where it's ingrained. They need that cue of light. And the squids get really sick. And they have all this bad. It's like you overate and you can't expel it. And so they get really sick and they can't expel the bacteria. And so that exfoliation gets rid of dead bacteria, old bacteria, and also being able to house that many bacteria all the time is much more energetically costly than saying, okay, I'm going to bed now. It's sunrise. I don't need all these bacteria. I'm just going to push 95% of them out the door. And then just the remaining 5% I'll keep to grow up for the next night.
So it doesn't have to take in any new bacteria. I mean, it sounds like, but it doesn't have to. You can just regenerate from the 5% that are left.
Yeah, so they don't take up any new bacteria. What happens is that once the bacteria initially infect the juvenile squids, all the morphological features that entrain water to go towards the pores and the mucus that gets secreted, that gets shut down. So it's like once you got your symbionts, that's it. We're not letting anyone else in. We've got the ones that we need, and they're the ones that are going to stay.
I was wondering about the term infected. You said that the squid is infected, which has such a negative connotation medically, but I guess technically, biologically, just means that the bacteria have taken up residence, right?
Yes. Yeah. We also say colonized, you know, so that's, I guess, a nicer term, but they do infect the squid. You just have to remember that these are beneficial bacteria, so they're not causing any harm.
Now, does a beneficial strain of bacteria ever become pathogenic? Can it evolve to become the kind of guest who takes over the whole house and won't leave, for instance?
Yeah, it's a great analogy. There's been some speculation. So if you look at the relationship, say, between Vibrio fischeri and Vibrio cholerae on the Vibrio phylogenetic tree, they're not close to each other. So in terms of being related to each other, they're similar, same genus, different species, but they're not like sister species to each other. What's interesting on the Vibrio tree of life is that a lot of the pathogens are related to one another, and the beneficial bacteria tend to group in a different part of that tree. And so they think that a lot of the pathogenic genes are carried around on islands that sometimes can be transmitted either through viruses. So viruses, you know, when they infect, these are bacterial phages. So these are viruses that infect bacteria. They infect a bacterium, they get in there, and like a lot of viruses, they can go into this life cycle where they sit inside the chromosomal DNA, and then something will trigger them to pop out. And when they pop out and they encase their own DNA, sometimes they take some of the host DNA with them. And if they happen to be near, say, one of these pathogenic islands, they can pick up some of those pathogenic genes, package them, it kills the host, so the bacterium explodes, the virus particles go off into the water, and then they infect a new bacterium and again inject their genetic material into the genome. And with that, they've taken some of that previous host DNA, so they can insert it. So that's one way a lot of bacteria DNA gets moved around. The other way is just through DNA transfer. It's something called transformation. And it can be done on extra chromosomal DNA and move them around. Some of these pathogenic ions are carried on these little bits of extra chromosomal DNA called plasmids. And like a lot of antibiotic resistance genes can be carried this way. And bacteria can also conjugate, less so across species boundaries, but, you know, like with viruses or just taking up foreign DNA, other ways and conjugation where they actually mate. You can see there's lots of examples of chimeras in the bacterial world, and that's probably due to the fact that they have all these different mechanisms of moving DNA around. So it could be that you get a few nasty genes in there that get moved over to a beneficial bacterium, and then they get picked up and possibly used to that advantage.
I wanted to also ask you about evolution, and I would imagine that this is a pretty new area in terms of how did the squid evolve to take in bacteria, and how did the bacteria evolve to be attracted to the squid? And it seems like sort of an amazing dance, and sort of wonder how it ever came about. And like, I was wondering if does the bacteria first find a chink in the host's armor, and then somehow the host biology recognizes the benefit? Or is it possible that in addition to an immune system, which might be akin to an army of bouncers in a neighborhood bar, we also have a welcoming committee system? I don't know what that would be called biologically, but how does this happen?
Yeah, so a lot of times the symbioses are very loose. They start off in a relationship where the bacterium is kind of hanging on or around the host, and somehow it ends up always associated with a particular tissue or tissues. Then the host, maybe either as an immunological response, might form tissue around it, or either try to separate it. But if those bacteria may be producing compounds that are beneficial for the host might say, okay, this might be a good thing. So maybe I'll envelop these bacteria, but not to kill them. So they won't be sicking their immune system on these bacteria. Instead, they'll be figuring out a way to accommodate those bacteria. And it's a case like with these bobtail squid and vivrifishi. The squids have a very primitive immune system. It's called an innate immune system. So all invertebrates have this system. We do too. But we also, as advanced multicellular organisms, we also have an adaptive immune system, which is really, really fantastic. But the innate system is one that is like the first responders on your side of infection or whatever. The macrophages go in there, that kind of thing. Somehow these bacteria have been able to accommodate squid's innate immune system. So they get recognized, but they don't get killed and they don't get eaten. They just get, they're just let alone. Whereas other types of bacteria are recognized as harmful or invaders. So it's almost like, okay, I have my green card and here I am. And no one understands how that crossing the being someone who's not able, a bacteria that's not able to get let in versus ones that are, that hasn't been discovered. That's one of the questions that a lot of symbiologists have is like, how did these two things start getting together in the first place? They're so closely knit. Some of these symbioses, like the hydrothermal vent animals, where they rely on the bacteria for nutritional aspects. If they don't have those bacteria, they croak, right? They are toast. With our guys, if you grow them in the lab and you don't have the bacteria present, you can raise the juveniles to adults. So nutritionally, they're not dependent on these bacteria. They're more used for a behavioral response to light, with the counter illumination. So
we don't understand how the keep out sign becomes a welcome mat.
Yeah, and so what happens, at least what we're just discovering in this system, is that the squid actually has, I'll give you one example, these enzymes called haloperoxidases. They're actually in our white blood cells too, and they're used to get rid of bacteria. It's like, that's why hydrogen peroxide is such a good thing when you clean out open wounds or whatever, right? And so what happens is that the squid's hat releases these, we call them squid peroxidases, squid haloperoxidases, and they release them when the bacteria are infecting the light organ. So most bacteria die. They conk out because they can't resist this peroxidase. But Vibrio fischeri that have evolved with squid, they produce an enzyme that counteracts the haloperoxidases. It's called the catalase, and they produce high levels of this. A lot of bacteria can produce it, but the Vibrio fischeri from squid produce high levels of this catalase. And what the catalase does is it cleaves hydrogen peroxide and turns it into water. So it turns a real nasty chemical, hydrogen peroxide, to water. But not all Vibrio fischeri can do this. So there are Vibrio fischeri that are free-living vibrofoschi that never infect squid. And if you present them with peroxidase, they die. They can't, they don't make enough catalase to do it. So like I said, there's these strain types, squid, vibrofoschi, free-living vibrofoschi. And even though they're all the same species, they are really subtly different. So we think that that's something that they've evolved over time, being affiliated with squid, is that they've just said, okay, we need to amp up our game here. So even though squid's still giving us the unwelcome mat, we're going to come back and say, okay, we've got these enzymes to get us past this first gauntlet. You know, it's kind of like a series of, almost like Indiana Jones, where you have to go through all these things and you finally get to the end. So
I guess once the bacteria realizes that they're, well, realizes, I'm anthropomorphizing here, but once the bacteria detect that there's a potentially hospitable environment or partially hospitable environment, then perhaps it could evolve such that some subset of them find themselves even better adapted to that environment. And I guess this equivalent thing happens in the squid's end.
Yeah. We're even finding the subtle differences. So one thing we did is some experiments between vibrofoschi from Hawaii versus vibrofoschi from Australia. We had both types of bacteria in the lab, and we had squids from Australia. And one of my students did these series of experiments. They're called experimental evolution. So you're evolving organisms in the lab in response to some selection pressure. In this case, we're changing host squids. So with these experimental evolution studies, what you do is you present, in this case, we present vibrofoschi from Hawaii to Australian host squids, so a different host. And the two different vibrofoschi from the Australian Hawaiian squids phenotypically have different attributes. So one is brighter. The Australian strain is a little bit brighter in luminescence. It also makes a lot better biofilms. The Hawaii vibrofoschi are kind of crappy biofilm makers. They colonize squids well, but just so when you take them in the lab and you kind of look at these differences, there are some major differences between the two strain types. So this is work that my grad student Will Soto did. He took the vibrofoschi from Hawaii and he evolved it over 500 generations in a Hawaiian squid. So basically, you're always letting these vibrofoschi from Hawaii only seeing a different host. And what happened over 500 generations, and this is a beautiful, beautiful study, but you can imagine it takes someone in the lab a long time to do these studies. What happened was these vibrofoschi from Hawaii started looking like vibrofoschi from Australia. So when they start off as being poor biofilm formers, then they turn out to be really good biofilm formers. When they weren't making very good light production or luminescence, they started making better light production. And the beauty of bacteria is that you can freeze them and put them away in the freezer and store them, but then you can bring them back to life. You just freeze them down in glycerol so their membranes don't deteriorate, but then you can reculture them. That's the nice thing about working with bacteria. So you can take your time zero experimentally evolved bacterium, and we call it a frozen fossil record. It's like a fossil record. And you can compete it against your 500 generation one to see how it does against its ancestor. So it's like looking at the human evolutionary tree, and you took Homo habilis and you compare it to Homo sapiens and say, okay, what's going on after this many thousands of years of evolution, right? So what Will found out is that it's, when you competed against its ancestor, it wins in a competition in a light organ. So now, like at time zero, they're equal, right? Because you have, you know, you didn't do any evolution, but over time, 100, 200, 300, 400, 500 generations, it's significant to where the ancestor now is better than the original, the evolved strain is better than the ancestor strain.
That's amazing. How long does it take to do 500 generations?
Oh, about a year in the lab. And what happens is that, yeah, you keep evolving these things, but the bacteria generation time is fast, but you have to wait for the squids to come out and the batches of squids to come out to keep evolving them in the host. When you do these kind of, you can do these experiments in a test tube. Okay. So in a test tube, you're just transferring every day. So evolution in a test tube goes much faster, but of course you're just mimicking some environmental constraint in a test tube. It's not the actual animal. So doing these experiments in animal are much more revealing in terms of what's going on. but they're also more time consuming. And the squids don't always cooperate too. Like, you want to do your experiments like Wednesday, and the animals don't hatch till Friday. And so you're trying to time everything right. But that's just science.
So do you have to worry at all about accidentally introducing a different bacteria into the environment? I guess that's on everyone's mind with the coronavirus and the lab leak hypothesis and all that. I mean, of course, you're not dealing with the coronavirus, but is that something you have to protect against? You know, particularly if you're anywhere close to water?
Yeah. So what we do, you know, here in Merced, we were in New Mexico, so no marine organism is going to survive even in the Rio Grande. but even in Merced, we're still, you know, hour and a half from the coast. We autoclave everything. So just whenever you're doing kind of research with genetically manipulated organisms, even the wild type, after we've done our experiments, you autoclave or bleach everything, so you kill everything. So there's specific lab protocols that you just make sure that what you have from the wild doesn't go back out in the wild. Even if it was from that place, you never really want to introduce something that you've done some kind of manipulation in the lab. So researchers are very, very careful. When we do, we actually make up our own seawater, instant ocean. So we use artificial seawater for all our experiments here in Merced, even though we could get seawater, you know, very close by. It's just more controlled. We know exactly what's in the seawater versus going out to the ocean and you have no idea what's in there at that time. So.
And what do the bobtail squid eat?
So mostly small crustaceans, little shrimps. One thing that's probably the most costly thing about doing the research I do is that cephalopods in general are very picky eaters. They don't like dead food. You can train cuttlefish to eat like little fish blocks or squid blocks, but it takes a long time and they don't like it because, you know, it's like someone feeding you the frozen fish sticks versus freshly caught halibut. So we have to order our shrimp generally from Florida. And these are just shrimp caught off in the seagrass beds. And we have a distributor there. He flies out 1,500 shrimp. And our guys eat about 3 a day. So we feed them live shrimp. And I think a lot of it is just the tracking. They're very attracted to movement. So when you drop a shrimp in the tank and the shrimp are kind of darting around, the squids really track that. If you've ever seen one track their prey item, it's pretty amazing. And the way that squids hunt, very different from octopus, because octopus are always on the floor. They're benthic, but squids are pelagic, so they're, you know, swimming in the water column. So they have 8 arms and 2 tentacles. So squids have basically 10 arms. And the tentacles are always used for hunting. So the arms are kind of out, and the tentacles are tucked inside near the arm, or the oral area where the mouth is. And tentacles are very different from the rest of the arms, is that the arm part isn't covered with suckers, only the very tips where there are these big pads. And there are tons of suckers on there, because what they use is they shoot those out, and the musculature is really amazing. It's like a rubber band. It goes super fast. And they aim towards their prey. They catch the prey, and the pads at the end of the tentacles have these suckers. They grab on to the prey, and then they reel them back in. And then the arms are used for manipulating the prey so they can get it towards their mouth. And so they like doing that. They'll eat small fish, but shrimp, any kind of small crustaceans, really what they prefer.
Okay, so I have one last question that's a non-scientific question, and I'm just curious, do you eat seafood and do you eat squid?
So I do. And I should just mention that a long time ago when I was a postdoc and I started working on the system, I had to do a set of experiments where I had to do a lot of squid dissections in one day. I think I dissected, I don't know, over 100 animals. And dead squid, like not cooked squid, there's a certain smell that after that day, I didn't eat calamari for at least 10 years. And then finally, one infamous trip to Barcelona where they had made excellent squid, I finally got back to eating calamari. So yes, I do now.
I see. Okay. It sounds like you probably don't name your bobtail squid. You don't get that attached to any one individual.
No. They're pretty cute. You know, they're kind of chubby. They don't look like your typical market squid. They have big eyes. And so we think they're pretty cute.
Well, Nish, thank you so much for coming on. Michelle Nishiguchi, the professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, Merced. It's been really delightful to talk to you today. And thank you for enlightening me about something I knew very little about before.
Oh, great. No, it was great. Thank you for the invitation. It was great to talk to you.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.